Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. Welcome to the Talky Bit. I'm tempted to say welcome back to the Talky Bit because we've taken a couple of runs at this one. And also this series is one that we keep dipping in and out of. And I think I think partly what we're going to explore together today might help us collectively have a different view of why we're dipping in and out of this topic as well. There's been some of it's been logistics, but some of it is honestly about the topic and what it takes to approach something like this, even just air quotes around just, but just as a set of ideas, never mind as experiences. There are some sorts of things that I think we can take on a little more readily in life, largely through being determined and organized, valuable things to be when we're trying to accomplish something. There are other sorts of things that, no matter how determined and organized we are, they don't fall to determination and organization so readily. And as much as those are contributing, positive contributors, and we find ourselves in the terrain where being kind to ourselves and seeking necessary supports and engaging and disengaging over time become a really important part of dealing with, and I don't like the phrase dealing with much, engaging with might be better, whatever the challenges that we're facing. So that's partly also why we've been in and out of this. Part of it's circumstantial, part of it's deliberate. But I'm going to jump right into the heart of the matter today, a little bit of a review of where we left off last time because we've been in and out of this. And so I want to just review some of our consideration about what recovery from religious trauma and religious trauma syndrome might look like. And although I hope this is evident in our context, I should also deliberately note that this is a community consideration of these matters, not a therapy group for working them through. My aim, as always, is to encourage and equip us to explore what we believe. That's what this community exists to do, and that's the orientation that I'm coming from. I've used the metaphor here before of pebble tossing. We bring experiences and ideas into view in this setting for consideration, but we most often don't resolve them or deliberately shape them into a new system of belief. And that, I think, is an important way in which this community is different from many other We Believe settings. It's also something about this community that I realize can generate discomfort, but it's the path we've chosen collectively, and for my part at least, I want to be consistent in that. So, with that in view, a quick review of where we left off. We considered Peter Levine's outline for healing from trauma in general, which includes the stages of, so these are Levine's three stages for healing from trauma in general: leaving the environment, establishing safety, and releasing emotions. Those are the three big pieces. Levine's fairly progressive thinker in this discipline, continues to move into new modalities of treatment, and quite a consistent presence online in terms of offering public training and so on. So if you're interested in Levine's perspective, that's something that's quite accessible. You don't have to be a professional in the disciplines to access some of his work. So that's sort of this big umbrella. Leaving the environment, establishing safety, and releasing emotions as three stages of healing from trauma in general. And then we've focused in inside of that on Marlene Winnell's work. And Winnell is the person who's given us the phrase religious trauma syndrome. She's a primary thinker and academic and practitioner in that realm. And her work is focused directly on religious trauma syndrome. She outlines those stages of recovery a little bit differently. And she outlines them this way. So those are her steps. There's a few more. They overlap. We'll talk about that in a bit. But her steps are separation, confusion, avoidance. Quite the bundle, right? Separation, confusion, and avoidance. And then feeling and rebuilding. And not surprisingly, there's overlap, like I said. And the overlap runs roughly like this. For Levine's three-step or three-stage process, leaving the environment and establishing safety cover much the same terrain as Winnell's steps of separation, confusion, and avoidance. So that's the overlap in terms of those systems, all right? So we stayed with Winnell's outline in our exploration, so I'm going to recap some of the key ideas about those first three stages, and then we'll get into the next one. So in our consideration of what might prompt separation from a harmful environment or from harmful ideas, we referenced when we explored that the contemporary Christian mystic Richard Rohr, who says that enlightenment, and I want to be clear here, by enlightenment in this context, we mean the act of gaining understanding or knowledge. So we're not talking about bolt from the blue necessarily here, all right? That might be bundled in, but that's not the definition. And Rohr would say that enlightenment under that definition requires separation, which is not an idea that might just occur to us walking down the street looking for enlightenment, if we are, right? Requires separation, which he suggests almost always comes on the heels of either great love or great suffering. It's a pretty fascinating idea. And as soon as I started to dig into it a little bit, I was like, oh yeah, that just makes a lot of human sense. Coming to or even considering a new understanding of something we thought was solid for us can be very, very difficult. And that's not always the case. Of course, sometimes that kind of a shift of understanding feels like an obvious next step. But if you stand back and think about it for a minute, for leaving a harmful system of belief to feel obvious, like an obvious next step, probably also means that we had some sort of experience that offered such a clear illustration of a failing of that system that we could no longer ignore or deny the experience, right? So that's a hit any way you look at it. That's a hard thing to go through no matter what. Those sorts of experiences can be both external or internal. They can be dramatic. They can be incremental. But they add up to something like, this system of belief is no longer working for me, or perhaps even actively doing me or someone I care about harm, and I need to make a change. Right? So it can bundle together. It can add up to that. Something's got to give would be a, you know, colloquial way to say that. Which, in our exploration up to this point, led us to the recognition that it can be confusing, so separation first. Following on that, it can be confusing to begin to reconsider teachings that have guided our meaning-making, especially if our consideration takes us into terrain that assails those beliefs that we've held or that lead us to actively reconsidering beliefs that we've held. That's just ripping hard work. And in the midst of these kinds of explorations and experiences, we might find ourselves thinking thoughts like, what is even going on right now? Like, it can feel so profoundly disorienting that we just feel like, I don't even know what I think about my thoughts about this. It's just hard to know, hard to locate ourselves sometimes in those experiences. When we stop to reflect, we might see that we're thinking or behaving in ways like what we did when we were a child, when we were in formative stages, and that we're in active retreat from having to face the implications of what we're considering at the exact same time that we're pursuing that very consideration, all stirred together. Like I said, confusing, right? When we've been standing on something we were taught and even believed for ourselves was certain, and that gets called into question or it gets stripped away or it gets deeply challenged, it makes sense that avoidance would follow right behind. The reality of what has been lost can simply be too much to handle, and we have to turn away and regroup before we can circle back. This is often not tidy and linear. If we could see it mapped out, I think sometimes we'd be like, anybody here seen the movie Ishtar way back when? Horrible movie, like famously bad, but it also has a character in it that's a camel. That is purchased under duress and turns out to be blind. And the CIA, I think, is tracking this camel for reasons in the story. And somebody is watching this on a radar and says, is that camel blind? Yes. The reason I mention the story is because that's, if we could see our path through some of these things, That's what it would look like. It would look like, are we just utterly lost here? No sense of guided direction is what it can feel like sometimes. We don't know where we're going and how to get there, which in turn can make it hard to feel the emotions that need to be felt in order for recovery to move forward. Which brings us to the next stage in Winnell's model, which is feeling. So now we're going to talk about our feelings. Emotions, to use another word. You know, when you grow up in a worldview that privileges thoughts and ideas, which most of us have on this continent, that's the Eurocentric Western, if you want to use that language, view of the human person. We tend to elevate the rational. Won't get nerdy about the history. But when we grow up in a worldview that privileges that perspective, the life of the mind, we don't necessarily grow up with a strong skill set for working with emotions. That's not what was reinforced. And in some cases, it was not only not reinforced, but it was denigrated. It was put down. It was regarded as a weakness to show too much feeling. Right? Be strong. Get a grip on your feelings and all of that. Since the late 1990s, we have had, in this part of the world, we've had the language of and ideas about emotional intelligence. That's sort of the academic frame for this, to help us understand this part of our lived experience. And that can all be very helpful, and we'll consider it in a moment. But I want to reframe a bigger idea first, and we're back in the realm of ideas. Look at that. I was this is a personal experience that I had very recently, within the last couple of weeks, that really challenged me on this. So I was in a conversation in some of my other work with a very thoughtful leader in the helping professions, and we were talking about what it might look like to put together workplace training experiences for people in the helping professions that address the whole person and not just some segment of the person. And she said that when she thinks about people holistically, she thinks about body, mind, heart, and spirit. And I was making notes during this conversation. And in a visible setting, I was making notes on a flip chart, and I wrote those four words down, and I wrote them down with commas between them, and she just called me out, which was fabulous. I love when people do that in those settings, and she said that I had the words right. Those were in fact the categories that she'd mentioned, but that if she was writing them down, she would not put commas between them. She would put hyphens between them, signifying that they were all connected and not separate from one another. And here I was kind of separating out, you know, mind, body, spirit, heart, right? And she was like, no, no, no. Like this, not like this, not in boxes. It was a heads-up moment for me. It was a direct reminder of how profoundly embedded my ways, our ways of seeing the world can become, how unconscious bias can inform everything, right down to the punctuation. I did not deliberately put commas there. I did it. I didn't consciously put commas there. I did that because it's grammatically correct. But it was ideologically a problem, right? And so, like, to me, that's fascinating. That my subconscious just was like, yep, that's how you do that. And she was observing that from a different vantage point, saying, no, that's not how you do that. Not if you want those words to mean what I mean them to mean. All to say, when we talk about something like emotional intelligence or religious trauma, the ideas can be helpful. And also, it's important to not stop at the ideas, but to press on into potential discomfort of the experiences with these things. And when it comes to emotions, that's what we're really talking about. We're talking about things we feel. Our ideas about our feelings, because we can consider, and if we have the language for it, talk about what we feel, are important tools in this process, but they are not the emotions themselves. To put it another way, ideas about emotions are not emotions. So, when we consider a stage in recovery with a name like feelings, that's the stage we're in, we're reflecting on what it might be like to feel things. And because the whole realm we're in is one where harm has been done, where wounds have been experienced, we're not necessarily talking about pleasant feelings or emotions. And just a little quick aside, again, don't want to get nerdy about this, but I think it's important to clarify. So just an aside on this matter of how we feel about our feelings, too many layers. Generally speaking, it's important for this idea set to be helpful to understand that there are not bad or negative emotions, that's not a category. But most of us have feelings that we name that way, as a bad feeling. And so whenever I mention an idea like this, I sort of feel like I can feel the objections to the idea sort of percolating up in the room. So many of you might be well informed about this, but I want it to be sort of part of our consideration, shared consideration. So let me explain by what I meant by emotions just are. Emotions happen inside of us. They're a complex interplay between our body chemistry, our brains, in conversation with our minds. Even the experts can't agree on the sequence. So there's body-first theories, there's mind-first theories, there's two-factor theories. There's a whole bundle of theories around how these things occur and in what order. But everyone does agree about something. Everyone agrees that the pieces are interactive and the dance is complicated. That's pretty universal in the field of study. Having said that, we don't all experience emotions the same way. Right, again, duh, but worth saying out loud. Some of those emotions feel pleasant, some of them feel unpleasant, and everything in between. And even emotions that we might use the same language or name for, if we're naming our emotions, can feel more than one way. Right? We might have a pleasant experience with a named emotion, we might have an unpleasant experience with that same named emotion. And that's without even talking about emotions that are categorically complex, like jealousy, where we can have pleasant and unpleasant feelings in the same emotion at the same time. In any case, one of the emotions that often shows up at this stage of recovery from religious trauma is anger. Long way around, but we got there. In the complexity of trauma, there could be myriad reasons why that's the case. But there are a couple of reasons why that happens that frequently recur that are worth noting. So these are themes within the complexity. In recovery from religious trauma, anger almost always comes before and ushers in grief. And grief is necessary for healing to proceed. We can't mourn something that we haven't acknowledged. Again, don't drive into the ditch on this because it's a whole other realm, but famously Kubler-Ross's stages of grief start with denial. It's a particular study, so we need to be careful not to apply it to generic grief, but because it had a very specific context, that study. But nevertheless, we know just by our own lived experience that they're not gone yet is part of getting to they're gone, for example, if we're mourning a loss of someone or a departure of someone. So that's not, we're familiar in general terms with this idea that denial precedes grief. We're not as familiar with the idea that anger can be a signal or an ushering in for grief. In the complexity of trauma, I want to just touch on a couple of those themes. So we can't mourn something we haven't acknowledged. We have to get past denial. For many people, anger is the signal of that acknowledgement when it comes to this realm of trauma. And this is where we bump into what I mentioned earlier about what we might have been taught about anger as an emotion. If we've been previously taught that the acceptable response to upsetting circumstances is to forgive and forget, it's going to be a challenge to validate our own feelings in this. And the sequence for making progress in this is validate, regulate, reason. Like those are the dominoes in terms of dealing with some of these strong feelings, right? Also, that very validation is the key to acknowledging that something wrong has been done to us. And there are all sorts of ways this can be complicated, not the least of which is that some of those wrongs may have been committed or supported by people who genuinely love us and whom we love. And as a wise person from my undergrad years like to say, we can be sincere and be sincerely wrong. Our intentions are not the same thing as the impact of our actions. And most of us know this just from navigating everyday life. I mean, who can't find somewhere in their memory an exchange with someone they cared about where you find yourself saying, oh, I'm so sorry, that is not what I meant by that at all. Right? Like this is just garden variety relationship stuff, isn't it? That captures that same dynamic, but in maybe less consequential ways, depending on, you know, what the conversation's about and so on. For there to be a gap between intentions and impact, that's normal. It happens all the time. For the gap to be a space where injury, literal or psychological or spiritual, has happened, that adds weight to the impact of that gap, and it makes it harder to acknowledge that gap. There's more at stake. So, it's not that unusual for us in a process like this to exhaust ourselves trying to avoid or disconnect from those feelings. They're big, they're unruly, they're hard to manage. That's not a space we, most of us, it's not a space we're just like, yes, please, let's go there. And to add a little more complexity, Lots of authoritarian systems train people to believe that their anger is immoral. And again, we could get right into the weeds on this, but if you zoom out a little bit, you don't have to be any kind of a conspiracy theorist, I think, to ask, meaningfully ask the question, who is best served in this model by teaching people inside the model that their anger is immoral? Like, just 30 seconds of reflection on this takes us straight to, at least in my, from my perspective, straight to it serves the power holders best. Because now I have a great big psychological and psycho-spiritual lever with which I can manipulate people. And I can shut down their anger. Angry people bleep things up. Angry people make a mess of systems. So if you want the system to be tidy, and you can help people inside the system believe that their anger is categorically damning, that's a big lever, right? So it makes sense. Like, it's not illogical. It's not correct, but it's not illogical. Circle back for a moment. Anger is an emotion. Anger is neutral. What we do when we are angry, how we handle our anger, how we behave our anger, that is a connected but also separate matter. Anger is powerful stuff. And if we don't have the emotional intelligence skills, and they are learnable skills to handle it, we may well do something we regret in the heat of the moment. We might even do something that could be called immoral. We might do something wrong. We might cause harm. So the potential is there for that kind of behavior, but it's the behavior that's the problem, not the emotion. So separating those two is really important to growth in this. The aspect of anger that gets talked about a lot less is the possibility of it being transformative. Because anger is, among other things, an indicator of injustice. Mark Brackett, Mark is the director of the Yale Center for Emotional Intelligence, I think is the name of the organization. I think I got that right. I got the role and the name right. Mark likes to say that our emotions are like news flashes. They're messages from our psyche trying to get our attention about something that needs to be dealt with. Right? It's sending a signal. And if we learn how to interpret what the message means, we're going to make more informed decisions. That's a paraphrase, but that's the gist of how he would articulate that. So that's the terrain we're in here, right? Anger, one of the things that anger does fairly consistently is point us, if we pay attention to the message, to injustice. There are things in this world, there are things in some of our stories, in some of our lives, about which we should feel angry. If our radar is working, so to speak, the emotion we feel, because we're under threat in some way, will be anger. Our psyche will fire us up. It's doing its job. It's trying to protect us when it does that. It's a signal that something is wrong and needs to be addressed. Ideally, addressed in generative, helpful ways rather than in brutal, destructive ways. But the process of owning, I am feeling this, permitting, I will continue to feel this, and directing, applying emotional intelligence to anger, are all necessary parts of the work of reclaiming ourselves, first individually and then collectively. And this is when we try to extend this into the rule of law, for example, which is what we do collectively as society. So in terms of our communal engagement with this, that's why we have rules about demonstrations. Like, you have the freedom to demonstrate peacefully. So you're not free under the law to kill somebody because they did you harm. That's taking justice into your own hands. But you can surface that injustice, right? So again, there's a big complex realm there. But that's sort of a cursory way of illustrating the difference between these things. So we touched on this earlier, but I want to close the loop on it. Anger often serves as the gateway to grief. It paves the way for the feelings of loss and sorrow that are part of the recovery journey. And again, bit of a review here, but grief is a key indicator that an event, an experience in our lives has been relegated to the past, not the same thing as you're over it, to be clear, but chronologically, it has a place in the past. We can locate it in the past where it belongs, but it's often hard to get there without first of all experiencing anger. And most practitioners in this realm would say that it's not possible to get there without experiencing grief. And anger often ushers in grief. Right, so the bits are all connected. None of this is an easy task. period. And it's harder if we've been taught that anger is disobedience and disobedience is sin, for instance. So that's sort of potentially the religious layer in all of this, if you will. However, it is vitally important for people recovering from religious trauma to find safer spaces, both therapeutic and communal, that allow for expressions of anger. Those expressions can help discharge the energy that was trapped and built up during prolonged threat experiences, like growing up with this notion of judgment and damnation always waiting in the wings. That's a prolonged threat experience. And when you're a child, especially, there's no systemic way out of that that is within your control. All the ways out of that the system offers are within somebody else's control. They're within God's control, but not yours, which means that the threat never goes away. You're never empowered to remove the threat. And here's one of the keys to permissioning these things that many of us might find it hard to imagine. I will offer this as a thought, which of course doesn't make it real in our experience. There can be safety and acceptance on the other side of expressions of anger. We can learn how to self-regulate our emotions, including big, powerful ones like anger. One of my favorite quotes about this is that emotions are like kids in a car. You don't want them driving the car, but you also shouldn't stuff them in the trunk. You might want to stuff them in the trunk. I can relate to that as a parent. The trunk would be just right, you know, for you right now. But isn't that a picturesque way to think about this, right? You want to be able to keep them in the car so you can have a conversation with them. Don't want to hand them the wheel, don't want to stuff them in the trunk. There is the very real possibility that we can stay in the car, so to speak, and have those conversations and still travel together. That there can be safety on the other side of expressing these kinds of emotions. And that feelings won't overwhelm us or cause us to lose our relationship with our communities or our loved ones. Now, none of those ideas come with guarantees, of course. But they're good possibilities that unless somebody names them for us and walks with us into and through them, we might not even be able to imagine that those are possibilities, depending on our experience. So start there. This might be possible. We need to be able to learn that our bodies need our permission to acknowledge the feeling of anger in order to begin to heal. If we don't take ownership of it, if we don't give it a name, if we don't start listening for what the message is that it's trying to send to us, the message will get stuck. We won't get the message. And until we get the message, it's hard to make an informed decision about our actions. That means we're more likely to react than to proact, right, in those things. It's hard to move forward in recovery from these forms of trauma and belief systems without advocating for ourselves, internally and externally, and that often means getting angry about what happened to us, what was done to us. And again, that intersection of how do we navigate it if what was done to us was done by those we love and who love us, right? By communities that were precious to us and in which we were treated as valued and so on. These are not uncomplicated intersections. All right, that might be a lot to take in, but it's also where I'm going to leave it for now with this hopefully encouraging addition. Where we go from here in terms of this series is into some consideration of rebuilding. I realize that to go from this to that leaves a lot out, but what's in between there is intensely personal and unique to each of our journeys, and so there's limits to what we can do in this context with that. But that's where we're headed. Some consideration of what rebuilding might look like, some of the big pieces of that, because again, it's very individual. There's no shortcuts on this journey, but in terms of our exploration of this, but it is leading somewhere hopeful, and I look forward to engaging that part of it as well. And in the meantime, what we're here to do is to make a space where we can keep exploring what we believe, including what we believe about challenging things like this. Peace.